Good evening and welcome to the LSE. My name is Erik Bergloff. I'm a professor in economics, but I'm also director of the Institute of Global Affairs, and we are very delighted to have an opportunity tonight to launch a new initiative on global extremism, and we have assembled, I think, a dream team to think about that topic. So the problem of extremism is of course everywhere now, and in many societies, both in advanced and emerging and developing countries, are being torn apart, and particularly some of these countries that are struggling to build their political and social and economic institutions are seeing these being torn apart by extremism and creating deep fractures in society. And we think that this is an area that really deserves a lot more thinking. And we have called it global extremism because it is global, but also because we don't want to tie it to a particular part of the world or to a particular religion or a particular part of the political spectrum. It exists both in left and the right part of the spectrum. And we want to use this evening to shed light on it. It's obviously going to be some about Islam, but it's going to go beyond that. And we have, as I said, a panel. I'll let the moderator do the presentation, but I wanted to introduce the moderator, who is Jawad Iqbal, who is we're very fortunate to have him as a senior fellow at the Institute of Global Affairs, and he has a background at a senior executive at the BBC and been in charge of important programs like Newsnight and Panorama and so on. He's also a part of the council at Chatham House and someone that I had the pleasure of working with and developing this initiative, and he's going to lead it going forward. So I think the floor is yours, Jawad, and take it away. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Eric. Thank you very much, everyone. It's good to see so many people here. I'm just going to repeat this introduction by asking the panel to introduce themselves, partly because I'm scared to introduce them, they're so well qualified. So we'll just go through the panel very quickly, and then I'll just explain how we're going to do it. Elizabeth?
My name is Elizabeth Kendall. I'm a senior research fellow in Arabic and Islamic studies at Pembroke College in Oxford. And my speciality really is Arabic poetry, literature, and culture. That actually has quite a bearing on global extremism, but we'll get to that, I think. So I'm very pleased to be here this evening.
So I'm Stefan Hertog. I'm an associate professor at the Department of Government here. I work on comparative political economy issues, and among other things, I've co-authored a book about the question why there's so many engineers among Islamist extremists.
Good evening. My name is Azadeh Moveni. I am an old Middle East hand. I was a Middle East correspondent for many years. More recently, I am senior gender analyst at the International Crisis Group, looking at gender and conflict, women, sometimes men. I've spent the last few years working, researching women in ISIS, and I also have an old life in which I was an Iran specialist.
Hello, everyone. My name is Peter Newman. I'm a professor of security studies at the Department of War Studies at King's, and I founded and ran the International Center for the Study of Radicalization, ICSR, for 10 years, until early this year.
Great. Thank you very much. Now, my plan is that we will talk for 45 minutes, and then I've allocated 45 minutes for Q&A. I hope, does that seem reasonable, or would you like more Q&A and less talk from here? Okay, so we'll aim for that. And if you feel at any point that there's something you really want to ask at that point in the discussion, if you could just signal to me something not abusive, and I will come to you at that point. Okay, so I want to start with a really very easy question, which is I want to ask the panel what they think we are talking about when we talk about extremism and global extremism. Perhaps you could start, Peter.
Of course. So I've actually written an article about that, and I came to the conclusion that obviously extremism, like radicalization, but in particular extremism, is a context-specific and context-dependent term. That doesn't mean that it is entirely meaningless, but it only becomes meaningful if you actually understand the context within which it is being used. So I can say, within the context of Britain in 2018, a neo-Nazi group is extremist, knowing that in the context of 1935 Germany, it probably wouldn't have been extremist. But I'm very happy to defend the idea that within the context of today's Britain, that is a group that is extremist. I would say within the context of liberal democracies, every group that advances a system of government that basically is supremacist, wants to abolish democracy and say that because of certain features of your physical appearance or because of your religion, you are superior to other people, all these systems within the context of liberal democracy, I would consider to be extremist. Within the context of Middle Eastern dictatorships, perhaps it's more difficult, but that's why we have the experts here.
Yeah. I think that's a great question to start with, and I think that I tend to largely agree with Peter that context is our guide when using this kind of language. I tend to avoid it in my writing and my journalism. Crisis Group tries to avoid it as well because these words mean so many different things to different people with different often agendas and relationships to state power around using them. I think they have wholly different contexts, as Peter says, if we're talking about different kinds of state disorder and collapse in the Middle East versus racially supremacist or other kinds of groups in the West who are using political violence. I think we have a whole rich vocabulary of other words that we can reach for when we are using these shorthand terms like radicalization or extremism. We have insurgency, we have militancy, we have political violence, we have murder, we have criminal behavior, we have state terrorism, we have more to reach for. And I think that sometimes we get boxed into a counterterrorism space, and we'll, I'm sure, talk more about that when we use those specific words, because they're often prescriptive and they often are focused also structurally around questions of root causes and why that kind of box us into a certain approach rather than looking at how and how do we disrupt this and how are we going to deal with this to protect people or to end conflicts.
Stefan, I just want to qualify slightly. Mm-hmm. I mean, same question to you, but could you maybe quantify the term as well?
Mm-hmm. No. No, I would agree with Peter that without, there's no meaningful general definition. I mean, a kind of working definition that we might use for measurement purposes is non-state groups that actively use violence against people. But even that gets you into hot water. If you look at, like, say, anti-colonial liberation movements, are all of those extremists? So that works in a lot of contexts, certainly in the context of peaceful societies, but it won't work across all of them.
I also really like the idea that extremism must be defined according to context, or is defined according to context. And I have little to add to what my colleagues have already said, but it might be helpful if I perhaps bring a bit of ground reality to it. So, for example, in the Arabian Peninsula, where I've been researching, we're running into this definition of extremism: people who cooperate or work with terrorist groups are therefore extremists, and then perhaps also therefore worthy of being droned or being put on drone lists. But of course, in the context of where they are, they're simply going along with the only game in town or the best game in town. And so that's a really important distinction. One person's extremist is another person's, well, there's nothing better. And it's very important to make that distinction. And on that, I'll also just raise the question of, what exactly is radicalization? Because my work has shown that in an area that was under not Islamic State, but Al-Qaeda rule in Yemen for a whole year until 2016, there were probably only about 4,000 members of Al-Qaeda, but about 5 million people who were just going along with it, more or less. And so that's a really important question. It's not that everyone was terrorized into submission, everyone's got guns, they're used to death, they're used to fighting. It's much more about not joining the extremists, but tolerating them. And so I think it's very important to distinguish between what I call passive toleration and active radicalization.
Does anybody feel a strong desire to counter any of those definitions?
We'll be stuck.
Not yet.
You're a very, very reasonable audience. Okay. Can we?
You're too democratic.
Yes, probably. Can we just talk a little bit about some specific research which is new and relevant, which Peter and Stefan have been doing about ISIS recruitment and the sort of trajectory and the demographics, which will allow us to talk about some of the pathways into extremism and radicalization?
Perhaps I can say something about the data,
okay,
and then Stefan says something about what he's done with the data.
Okay.
So we were lucky enough to get hold. Perhaps a lot of you have heard about a year ago, a year and a half ago, there were these stories about these forms being discovered, ISIS membership forms, and amongst people who studied militancy and terrorism, the joke always used to be, well, you know, it's not exactly like they have membership cards. In fact, in the case of ISIS, in this particular instance, they did fill out forms. They did fill out standardized forms that were asking them for not only their date of birth, their previous occupations, their families, also their, you know, self-identification in terms of their religious knowledge. And we got hold of 4,000 of these forms, roughly, where people who'd entered, who were all so-called foreign fighters who'd entered Syria in 2014. We verified these forms, and it is perhaps the most complete sample ever of members of, for want of a better term, of a terrorist organization. And Stefan, with his mathematical skills, has analyzed them and found very interesting things.
So you can do all kinds of things with those data, because there's, I think, something like 50 or 80 variables per individual, including the blood type and the last residence and their phone number, so you can, you know, call them, check whether they're still alive. What we've done so far has mostly focused on some of the big puzzles of radicalization that have really remained unanswered for decades, which is the socioeconomic factors. You know, there's been a big debate about whether poverty causes radicalization, and I think it's almost generally agreed that poverty, in a kind of simplistic way, actually doesn't. Actually, a lot of people who are generally poor don't have the energy and the spare capacity to actually join radical groups, apart from very particular contexts. But there are kind of more nuanced hypotheses and ideas about how your economic context and your kind of class and status context shape your potential radicalization trajectory. And one of the things that we looked at there is levels of professional success, because we were able to code the professions of something like 2,000 members of that sample and assign a certain status variable to them. And there are methods to do that. And we also have pretty comprehensive information about their education. And what came out, which confirms what we know from a lot of other studies, is that they tend to be more educated than the background populations that they're from, than males from their countries of origin of obviously Muslim background and the same kind of age group. That's been sort of out in the literature, and we've confirmed that with better data. What hasn't been investigated yet, and which I think is very, very interesting, is that the professional success, according to the data that we have, on average, is uniquely low. So those are people with pretty good degrees and a pretty terrible CV, so pretty terrible professional accomplishment. Now, you can quibble about what the exact causality is, but I think we found a way to show that this is plausible evidence for what we call, or what sociologists in general call, relative deprivation. So a trajectory biographically where people have fairly high expectations that then get dashed by reality. And there's a whole host of social psychology research and sociological research arguing that this leads to frustration and potentially violent collective action. So we're kind of in that venerable tradition and argue that people who have high expectations, who actually work hard, who go to university, and then fail economically in terms of their status, in terms of their professional accomplishment, those are a particular risk group. Now, it's certainly not, I mean, there are many, many other factors going on, but there's a very specific bias throughout the data that seems to suggest that.
And what is the... two things. What is the age trajectory of your sample, and what is the gender divide?
The sample only has males, so we have to assume that the triage, when volunteers come to northern Syria, or used to come there, that they were divided by gender and registered in different centers, probably. Age-wise, it's the classical case that we know from all other studies of radicalism, that it's, you know, young males between kind of 16 and 30, and then there's a couple of older guys from a few countries with a very long tradition of radical mobilization, like Egypt, but by and large it's young males, so people with often less to lose and a very high tolerance for risk.
And is there do you get any sense of where the push is coming from in terms of, is it young, disaffected males looking, or is it ISIS looking at, which is the, what is the division there?
That's an excellent question of supply versus demand, and usually when you get whatever data on the membership of groups, you never know whether this is because those particular types sought out the groups, or the groups sought out them, and then in the end you don't know anything. I think for IS you can make a good case that they're so ecumenical in their recruitment, they're so open for everyone to come, that the patterns we see are predominantly supply, the supply function. So it's different from Al-Qaeda, which is very, very selective, goes for very particular types, only lets very small numbers into the networks. IS really opened the gates to everyone. So we do believe that it's mostly the supply, so people's kind of drive to go, that we see reflected in
and
the
composition.
And
that's also one of the really surprising findings, because if you had expected, I mean, if there had ever been any group where you would have expected a lot of losers, quote unquote, it would have been ISIS. I went with my colleagues in 2014. We went to some of the border towns in Turkey from where people entered into Syria, and we spoke to some of the recruiters that were transporting people into Syria, and we asked them, so who goes to ISIS, who goes to, as it was then, Jabhat al-Nusra? And they said that a lot of people wanted to join Jabhat al-Nusra, but Jabhat al-Nusra refused them because they couldn't pray, because they were smoking, because they weren't disciplined enough. And only when rejected did they end up with ISIS, who basically accepted everyone, because, of course, their philosophy was that they were creating the caliphate and there was a place for everyone. So everyone could come and join ISIS. And often they were receiving the rejects that were not accepted by other groups, that were more demanding in terms of religious observance, piety, etc.
So there was a couple of cases of, I mean, quite a few criminals and also a couple of drug dealers. And there was one drug dealer when the comment kind of column and said, oh, the guy dealt heavily in drugs, God help us all, but he was accepted.
Mm.
Elizabeth?
Yeah, well, that's really fascinating. I'm going to ask you a bit of a silly question now, but it's on the top of my mind. On that form that they were filling in before joining, was there any unusual question or any really super interesting question? And I'm thinking along the lines of, you know how when you fill in forms for companies these days, it always says, how did you hear about us?
Well, actually, in fact, as a matter of fact, one of the interesting things, and Stefan and I have only really started to clean up the forms, and Stefan has done like the first analysis, there's a lot of interesting aspects. One thing that I want to look into is the self-assessment of level of religious knowledge. So people were being asked, how good a Muslim do you consider yourself? And a very surprising number of them actually said, my religious knowledge is very low. And another aspect, which is actually facilitating potentially some kind of almost network analysis is the aspect of tazkiya. So in order to be accepted by an organization like ISIS, you typically need a reference. You know, they want, like, if you just turn up and say, you know, I heard about you in the news and now I want to join, they will probably suspect that you are a spy or that you, you know, you have not a good reason for joining. So they want to have a reference. They want to have a name of someone who basically recommended or basically vouches for them. So that's precisely what you are asking for. And in fact, in a surprising number, and you don't know this, Stefan, but we've looked at this, me and my colleagues, in a surprising number of British cases, the reference to tazkiya was Omar Bakri, who is the mentor, of course, of Anjem Chowdhury, who is now currently based in Lebanon. And a really, I can't attach a certain percentage to that, but a very significant percentage of British recruits that came into Syria in 2014 mentioned Omar Bakri as their reference.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So that's really interesting to see how all of that is being connected.
Just so I'm clear on this, then, are we saying that, based on your preliminary findings, that religious motivation, religious ideology, which is the basis of a lot of counter-extremism work here, is not actually the primary driving factor?
I think that's a very big question. That's one of the sort of central questions in this field. It's one of the big debates also about extremism. I don't think at this point I feel confident enough to give you a definitive answer to that. Because even if someone has a self-described low level of religious knowledge, it may be useful for him to become more educated by someone who has a different point of view from a theological perspective. So even if your religious level of knowledge is low, the solution may still come from theology, right?
Yeah, but so I certainly wouldn't reduce the phenomenon to socioeconomic frustration. I, at the end of the day, we're talking about a population potentially of a billion or so from whom you could recruit, and you get a couple of thousand people or a couple of 10,000 people ending up in that group. So there must be many, many things falling into place for an individual to make that radical and very potentially very costly decision. And there's some, I think, quite convincing writing by Graham Wood arguing that at least certain IS volunteers are very much ideologically motivated. And even if the kind of sub rosa psychological processes might have to do with frustrations that they even haven't fully rationalized or don't understand, I think in their own consciousness, religion and doctrine, which IS is very, very keen on, do play a quite prominent role.
Asada, you wanted to say something?
I just wanted to pick up on the idea of the form as part of maybe grounding us a little bit geographically in this discussion, because the form, which all of us who work on this have seen, I think is really a source of helpful granular knowledge that gives us important context about the countries and the different milieus that all of these recruits came from that are obviously also dramatically different. They've come from Europe, from largely peaceful societies, and they've come in much greater numbers from within the Middle East itself, countries that you know, have great issues with state disorder, collapse, Iraq, Syria themselves. So we're dealing with two very different contexts, and I would argue that the questions almost need to be almost completely different for these contexts. The form, for example, and I guess there's two other things here. As we look at this granular data to understand context, you know, how I think we need to acknowledge that we really don't know ultimately what will compel someone who comes from this kind of socioeconomic background with this kind of relationship with Salafism or Sufism or whatever. We don't know whether that person will become violent, because then you have vast numbers of people with precisely the same identity or religious affiliation or everything, that we don't know ultimately what compels someone to act violently, which I think is something to always bear in mind when we talk about radicalization, as though it's something we can empirically map. And I think the danger it takes us into is if we're looking at root causes and trying to draw too close a line, it ultimately takes us into this very, very bloated realm of countering extremism as an industry that essentially ends up dealing or encouraging or leading to states like the United Kingdom generally engaging with Muslims through the lens of terrorism and security. But back to the form, which is what I started with, you know, the form also won't ask you, you know, have you ever had to pay a bribe to a police? Have you ever been tortured in prison? I mean, we know through many, many accounts of especially men and also women. I mean, I've spoken to women from Tunisia who have gone through prison detention and have dealt with rape or a great deal of intimidation. We know that torture in prison and police brutality is a great, in lots of instances, has been a driver towards pushing young people especially to move towards more militant groups. So, you know, the form tells us a lot, but there are lots of things that the forms also don't ask that are an important part of the context.
Okay. We'll come to some of the prism through which these things are seen a bit later on, but I just wanted to, with you and Elizabeth, just talk about, this is a sample of men, but we do know that women are also being recruited or are attracted to some of these groups. And I know that both of you, you know, have interests and knowledge in that area. I just wondered whether you could share with us some idea of what's going on there in terms of what is the attraction, but what is also the methodology of working on women to make them attracted to this set of groups. Elizabeth, do you want to start?
Well, I have been working mostly on changing approaches by Al-Qaeda towards women, and that's really quite different from the way that ISIS approaches women. And I think that's what you've been working on, right? So it might be better if you start, and then I'll give the contrasting view.
Sure, I'm happy to. So I have spent a lot of time speaking to women who have joined ISIS from this country, from Germany, from Turkey, from Syria, Iraq. I was in Syria last summer. I mean, certainly by numbers, it is striking and noteworthy that it's the first kind of jihadist, self-identifying jihadist militant group that has attracted women in such numbers. You know, sometimes it's useful to remember what the numbers are, because I think the scope of which and the intensity with which they're covered by the media and the sensationalism of that makes us think that it's quite a lot more. I think in this country we're dealing with, you know, 100 plus or minus 20. Certainly not, you know, we're not in the, you know, four figures by any stretch. I mean, in Iraq and Syria itself, going back to our focus on context, I think, you know, these were countries that a border collapsed. There was an insurgency that grew out of ultimately the Iraq invasion of 2003. So it's really hard to kind of map the trajectory for women who were living in a town or a city like Raqqa that was taken over first by a collection of armed groups and then ultimately ended up in the hands of ISIS and became the capital, who joined because really they had to. You know, it was a matter of survival, and a lot of their families had stayed and they had to. There's a big group of women, or the numbers for Tunisia, for example, are very high as well. Again, a kind of outgrowth of the failure of the Tunisian revolution to really, I think, widely include a broad spectrum of political Islamists into the political process. There were a couple of acts of terrorism that I'm sure you all remember, the beach attack. This led to a big crackdown on a kind of broad spectrum of Salafi activism in Tunisia, and there were a lot of women who went into detention who you know, didn't espouse that kind of militancy, but eventually there was really no space left. Again, I don't say this to draw a causal connection, but to show the context in which women were ending up leading towards these kind of decisions. In Europe, it's a very different picture, I think, because a lot of recruitment happened online. A lot of the women from Europe were very, very young. I mean, I think the literature on it would tell you to think about things like cultural identity crises and a desire for adventure. I think you all probably remember the case of the girls from Bethnal Green who went. But we're very much kind of swept up in very, very active recruitment networks. I mean, I think that if we're looking at context, they felt and came from backgrounds that were quite economically marginalized. They felt a heightened degree of Islamophobia and street harassment if they wore headscarves. And kind of didn't really feel like they fit anywhere. But again, you know, there are tens of thousands of women like that who don't end up joining ISIS. So, I mean, I would say that I think gender is a really important prism because the groups themselves use gender and offer alternatives to Western feminism, offer a whole kind of language of empowerment that is appealing to, I think, young Muslim women in the West who feel that white feminism shuts them out, doesn't give them avenues for activism. This is all kind of part of the context, but again, you know, if there was no, I will always go back to, if there was no 2003 invasion of Iraq, if there was no rise of ISIS because of the Sunni insurgency and all of the disempowerment of a major section of Iraqi society that came of that, none of this would be happening to draw all these women in the first place. So, again, the context, I think, is important to us and fascinating, but the big structural conflicts that produce this, I think, in the end, you know, kind of override the gender strategies of the groups themselves.
Okay. Elizabeth?
Well, I think there are two different ways of looking at this. There are, of course, the women who are attracted to groups like Islamic State from the West and from Europe, but there are the ones in the field who are trying to be inside the Middle East who are being attracted locally or being sucked in to support locally. And what we've seen in Islamic State is that there has been a little bit of a loosening of the very strict nature of being a wife, mother, and a support to being perhaps a bit more active and possibly even taking up a weapon if you have to. And this is not to be taken as a sign of a newfound gender equality. This is basically a needs must. It's born of necessity. So we've seen a little bit of that emerging since December last year. But Al-Qaeda has a very different approach. It's certainly not looking for women from the West to come and join its group. It would rather that didn't happen. And it's really designed to, perhaps out of fear, to tell women at the moment, you have to stay indoors. This is your role. Don't get any funny ideas. We're in a conflict zone. Women are therefore naturally becoming more empowered because the men are away at the front. They're taking on roles that are not traditionally female roles. But don't get any funny ideas. Your role is in the home. And this magazine that started to come out from Al-Qaeda, it was really Al-Qaeda-linked group in Syria that produced it, called Beytuki, Your Home, is an absolute gem. And the telegram wire that the same group runs is re-forwarded again and again inside all the jihadist telegram groups that I'm in. And it's very much designed to tell women that they have a very, very valuable and important role as a wife and a mother, and they should be making their home a paradise on earth for their husbands, but they shouldn't really be leaving the front door if possible. And one of the ways in which it does that is it gives lists of instructions. For example, you know, how to please your mujahid, how to please your holy warrior, and that there are all sorts of funny instructions. There's a list of 60 that I came across the other day. One of them is, be on standby in the morning while he dresses. Casey needs. Be careful to choose his clothes for him the night before so he doesn't get stressed in the morning. And then, of course, an advice column for ladies. What do you do if your husband wants to take a second, third, or fourth wife? And it immediately rushes in and says, well, don't be cross. This is perfectly his right. You should be a support. You should support this decision. And you should think about the upsides, which involve things like you can share the housework with her. And if he's got another source of pleasure, he might cheer up a bit and therefore you'll be in a nicer position yourself because your home will be happier. There was also a very funny question, which was, what do women get in paradise? What's in it for us? And the answer was, if the guy gets 72 virgins, this is basically on the wire on the Telegram group, but it got thousands of views. And the answer was, don't worry, ladies, you will be prettier than the virgins of paradise. Hooray. And you will also be of a higher social status. So everything that comes out on this wire is extremely male-oriented. And the wire has also been very careful to criticize Islamic State whenever it feels that women are overstepping the mark. One such occasion was the Paris cell of women that were discovered. Al-Qaeda actually published a guide with the pros and cons of that Paris cell operation, which was dedicated to our sisters in France. And it was essentially saying it didn't censure the ladies. It didn't really tell them off directly. It told off the men for allowing the women to go and plan an operation, saying that this is totally compromising their honor and it's disrespecting women. So it always makes it sound as though it's supporting women, when in fact, of course, it's very much limiting them.
Jamal, can I add one thing to this? Because I obviously agree with everything, but I think one factor is missing, which is the supply side, and which is the changing nature of the project and the narrative. So before ISIS came along, and even at the beginning of ISIS, the appeal that groups like Al-Qaeda were sending out, and even predecessors of ISIS at the beginning, was we are fighting against someone. And the appeal was for young, able-bodied men who could be fighters. So come to Somalia, come to Afghanistan, come to Nigeria and fight against our enemies. What ISIS did from 2014 onwards was something fundamentally different. It said, yes, we're still fighting and we're still looking for fighters, but we're also creating a new society. We're creating the new caliphate. And for that caliphate, we need fighters, but we also need teachers, we need nurses, we need mothers of the new generation of fighters. And from that point onwards, and you can see that very clearly in the figures, women didn't start coming in 2013. They started coming in 2014 when ISIS declared the caliphate. And they came, in some cases, with entire families. We had 65-year-olds going to Syria and Iraq, not because they wanted to fight, but because they wanted to build a society. And that was a different narrative that included women, whereas before, Al-Qaeda did not necessarily directly appeal to women.
And that really makes the Islamic State stand out. So if you look historically at Islamist groups using political violence, there's pretty much none with women in operating roles or with any kind of prominence other than happening to be a wife and helping with the logistics. So that's fundamentally new. It also breaks a more general pattern where women in militant groups historically have pretty much almost always been on the radical left as part of an emancipatory movement. So in some cases, they've constituted half of the left-wing extremist groups in Europe in the 60s and 70s. And they've always been absent from the radical right, as well as Islamist groups. So it's really a fundamental shift in quality that a group that is sort of radically backward-looking and conservative has managed to recruit women in significant numbers.
Did you?
I just wanted quickly to say, although the women's recruitment numbers are high, I think certainly, and this is something that I think we struggle with in the evolving field of gender and conflict studies, is to look at how masculinity and femininity and women and men, their lives are intertwined, but how they are impacted by violence is obviously different. I wrote a piece for the New York Times called Dreaming of the Caliphate, and it was about how this appeal, the ISIS appeal of the nation state, resonated at a time post-Arab Spring when a lot of these hopeful revolutions had failed, when it really felt like the Arab nation state project had failed. It had failed to offer lives of economic dignity and opportunity to the vast majority of their citizens. So the idea of going to this new state, and of course all of the ideological messaging that was very strategically savvy for ISIS, was appealing to societies where the state had really failed, where the notion of citizenship didn't mean anything anymore. I met lots of women in Syria last summer who had gone with their husbands, and they had gone as couples because there was just no work anywhere. And they were trained, and they were highly trained, and they were graphic designers, and they were doctors, and they just wanted to have lives of some kind of dignity. And the idea of a state that protected you in the name of Islam didn't sound so kooky when the secular Arab dictatorship was rapacious and offered you no prospect of even a dignified, modest, quiet life, not even expecting politics, but just dignity and subsistence.
We're running against time, as I knew we would, and I want to turn to some UK and European issues, but just to round off this section, I'm not troubled, but I'm slightly, just so we're clear, I'm getting two things from your collective comments. One, a degree of sophistication around ISIS and Al-Qaeda that, in terms of understanding their audience, for want of a better word. But secondly, this emphasis that if only life was better here, these problems would be resolved. And I'm not saying I disagree with that. I think there are plenty of people who would think, actually, there are plenty of disadvantaged people, there are plenty of people with not great marriages and all kinds, who are not thinking that this strange self-declared state is some heaven or some equal opportunities regime. So I just want to be clear about what you think the sort of balance of your viewpoints is here. Anyone?
So, everyone? When you're trying to explain radicalization, when you're trying to explain why a particular person became a terrorist, as you said, you'll always run into the difficulty that whatever explanation in terms of big factors you come up with is not specific enough. So exactly as you said, everyone who's poor, who's relatively deprived, who comes from a particular background, for everyone who joins a terrorist organization, there are 10,000 people with exactly the same profile who did not. And there's two things following from that. The first thing is that the best way to talk about this is in terms of risk factors. Whilst I cannot predict whether a person will become a terrorist, I can say that if that person hangs out with skinheads, if that person starts talking or wearing swastikas on his arm, if that person starts talking about wanting to die for the cause, that person is at a higher risk of becoming a violent extremist than someone who's never been in touch with that sort of movement. So it's useful to speak about risk factors like you would, for example, do in health. Not every smoker dies of lung cancer, but there is a very significantly higher risk that you do. So that's one point. The other point is that when it comes to radicalization, because terrorist organizations are such small entities and such few people become violent extremists, it is absolutely critical to look at time and place and opportunity. Someone who has had exactly the profile that Stefan described and who wasn't unlucky enough to run into Anjem Chowdhury and to connect with him probably didn't end up in Syria, where someone who did might have done. Even in that case, it's not 100% certain. So it is about social factors, it is about who you know, it is about where you are. The reason why we had so many people going from Luton has nothing to do with Luton per se. It has to do with the fact that for a very long time, there were two very active Al-Qaeda recruiters coming from Luton, who were basically picking people up there. The fact that Bradford, which actually based on socioeconomic factors, should have recruited a lot more people also has to do with the fact that it was missing the presence of these two or three individuals who were picking people up. So it is about circumstantial factors in the end, as well as these big socioeconomic factors.
Okay. Does anyone else want to add anything very briefly?
might add something to that. I completely agree with how Peter has articulated that problem. I want to... No, it's very unusual for me to agree with someone. You shouldn't take it as a compliment.
All right.
I just do want to bring the focus back very quickly to, you know, how this works inside the Middle East rather than how it works in London, Paris or Brussels. Because it's essential, really, for people to have a go-to address. You need the state to take root in the field in order for a foreign fighter to have somewhere to go and to train and to settle. And so my work has been very much interested in looking at how that works on the ground. And I have done a lot of information gathering and survey work in Yemen during the Al-Qaeda state that ran until 2016. And here's what's so interesting. The ways in which I have concluded that getting this state entrenched happened were all kinds of ways that have really been under the radar of most Western intelligence agencies, because they're not obvious to us. So, for example, I categorized every single tweet that Al-Qaeda put out in the Arabian Peninsula for the whole time it was extant. This is on its governance Twitter feed, and established that 56% of all of its tweets were about community development projects, and only 3% were about the hudud punishments of Islamic law, chopping someone's hand off, stoning someone for adultery, that kind of thing. And yet, of course, everyone always leaps on that 3% as though that's representative, because it makes a better story and it's a better media-friendly story. And because the kinds of intel agencies that put out this stuff, it's their bread and butter. So, of course, it means that the way in which it's tackled is skewed. And the second thing that was missed is that people are not really noticing the youth engagement. They're noticing where they are, what operations have they done, how many guns do they have, what are they planning next, but not things that I noticed. Like, they're having an ice cream eating competition for young boys, Al-Qaeda. They're having a design your best anti-drone poster for kids in schools. They're having a who can give us the best poem about hating America competition. And these competitions, even for 11 and 12 year olds, have got prizes like motorbikes and Kalashnikovs. It is going to be a long battle,
just like
this. Even though the state has been uprooted. These minds must be influenced going forward. And then the final point I would make is that the other thing, this is my last bit, that was totally under the radar was, of course, the way in which, at least in the Arabian Peninsula, and I think this is probably different in ISIS territory, ideas very radical militant jihadist ideas spread in desert areas, remote areas, where people were illiterate and they didn't really have the internet. Of course, it was poetry. And I'm very happy to answer questions about poetry when we come round to it, but I won't bang on about it now.
Thank you. That allows us just to turn to events here to some extent or in Europe. I just wanted to pick up Elizabeth's point about young people and whether we really understand the phenomenon of extremism through the prism of young people, the mechanisms by which they're picking up information here, the things that they're connecting with and why, and whether the approach here, you know, even almost 20 years after 9/11, is still rather broad brush instead of actually focusing on the specific things. I just wondered whether any of you had a view about the state of the fight against extremism in the UK and Europe at the moment. A very easy question.
Peter?
I mean, I think I'll take it. I think you've deduced by now that I think that generally the counterterrorism or the countering extremism agenda is too broad. I think it's ever growing. And I think as we try and, I mean, I think our discussion tonight has been a lot about looking at whys and context and then looking at hows. And what do we do with these two different approaches and which one is supposed to be the most constructive for us? I tend to think that what Peter said about disrupting networks of recruitment is ultimately where the focus should be as we deal with countering extremism. Because in the end, you know, if there are two active guys in Luton and there's, you know, a woman in Whitechapel who's preying on these kids who go to Bethnal Green Academy, it's just the job of the police and the safeguarding authorities to disrupt that from happening. It's just good old-fashioned policing. Whereas I think what we're dealing with now in terms of the fight against extremism is this ever-broadening tent where anything to do, especially, well, as with Muslims, is shoved under that. So does an organization want to fight domestic violence or arranged marriage? Well, then it gets its money from, largely has to access money through the security services, so they can then kind of see the list of people who show up. Or risk factors, I think, are really important, but how broad are they going to be? If as an academic, I'm charged with, under my prevent duty, raising it as a concern if my first years and my second years are starting to cover their hair and wear hijab, I mean, is that too much? Are we ultimately securitizing too much of ordinary life and observance at the expense of maybe creating more problems that we don't already have that would have been kind of contained to people who are vulnerable and fall into the hands of those networks?
What is the method of recruitment? I mean, you've mentioned Omar Bakri Mohammed and Jim Chowdhury. I mean, Chowdhury's coming out of prison, but other people mentioned social media. What is the current, you know, there used to be the mosques, now that doesn't seem to be such a big issue, allegedly. What is the pathway in Europe for finding vulnerable people and influencing them at the moment?
I think that's very difficult to answer because there are different pathways and different places. I think there's not one particular place, not one particular physical place that you can tie it to. I do think that if you look across the board, for example, at where people were coming from, that went to Syria as foreign fighters, you see across Europe that you have these clusters in what may seem like unlikely places, small towns, Cardiff, Brighton, not that small, but, you know, perhaps not the biggest towns. You know, in Belgium, about 40% of foreign fighters in Belgium came from a town called Vilvoorde, which is a suburb of Brussels. In Germany, from Wolfsburg, from Solingen, also small towns. And what all these clusters have in common is, as you said, is the activity of a charismatic individual who often was picking up people that in some cases were frustrated, in other cases were not frustrated, but were still looking for something, and created a very tight friendship group, created a group that basically satisfied very intense emotional needs, the need for community, the need for belonging, for purpose, for adventure, for power in the case of many men, for domination, an exciting vision. In 1,000 years' time, people will still be talking about the young men from the West who went to recreate the caliphate. So it offers a lot of things that society no longer offers. Plus, and this is where the religious aspect comes in, it offers some kind of reward and something spiritual that goes beyond bungee jumping or being part of a football team. So that's why I said before, I don't want to completely rule out the religious aspect, because a lot of these people are not religiously sophisticated. They don't understand a lot about religion, but they do think there's something extra, something on top of being part of an exciting team that comes with being part of that group. And as far as the internet is concerned, There's a lot of evidence that shows that very few processes of radicalization happen exclusively on the internet, even though the internet can be a starting point. So I challenge everyone to go on a Salafist website or Salafist Facebook site today. Maybe not, but you know, if you dare, go on that site and just ask, what is Islam? You know, just post a comment under one of the pictures, what is Islam? I would like to try to understand what Islam is. I can guarantee you, within 10 minutes, someone will be in touch with you and will provide an answer. I cannot guarantee you it will be a good answer, but it will be some answer. And these people are very proactive. They reach out to people. They look for people who are looking. And the problem is that the rest of society doesn't deal with people who are looking for something.
Okay, yes. I want to throw it to the audience in a second, but just one last thing. I mean, it's partly based on your specialist interests, but we have focused on Muslims and Islamist extremism. And, you know, in theory, the title of the debate is global extremism. Do you think there's a danger that, for all the right reasons, there is a focus on Islamist extremism, but at the same time, there is a whole sphere of other extremisms that are either not really being addressed or discussed or are actually, you know, profiting quite well from this particular, and living off it to some extent and using it in very similar ways to develop their own goals. So do you have any very brief thoughts on where the threshold lies for all of these other extremisms at the moment? Is it much worse than it was? Is it just what it's always been? What is your sense of that?
Well, I might just say here quickly that in the militant jihadist groups in which I'm a member, there's a lot of talk about extremism. I don't mean as myself. I mean,
you can't take that back.
I was wondering, Elizabeth.
I just saw a couple of people in the audience looking at each other. There's a lot of talk about extremism and even, you know, the word terrorism, but of course they're referring to America, because that, for that, you know, things that are being done and perpetrated by regime such as the Trump regime administration, and I'm in no way agree with this, obviously, I'm just reporting what I find, are considered to be extremist. So there's extremism and there's extremism, and as we said at the very beginning of this, it's come full circle. And one other, just on the other side of that, I do think that social media and the Twitter generation, of which I'm a part, does encourage polarization, because A, you've only got 280 characters, and B, there are no prizes for sitting on the fence. You know, you want to get followers or be liked, then you adhere to a particular view. If you're sitting on the fence or trying to be moderate, you're pleasing neither one camp nor the other. So it tends to encourage polarization.
Stefan?
I do think that, you know, in terms of numbers, there are probably more right-wing extremists in Europe than Islamist extremists, if we think of people who are willing to use violence for their political ends. But there's a particular difference in that the radical right-wing seldom goes for very high-profile targets. And often they're very lower-class people, they're quite badly educated, and they're often not even organized enough to pull off something big. So the kind of big right-wing bombings you can count off in one hand in kind of post-Second World War history. So I think the radical Islamist groups are much more like historically the radical left-wing groups, like, you know, the Baader-Meinhof group, the Red Brigades in Italy, who were better organized, more tightly organized, and went for very, very high-profile operations. That then brought, you know, a very, very strong reaction of the type we now see it with Islamist groups. There's a puzzle about why the right wing is kind of so bad at political violence, given that it's so much really part of their ideology in a way.
Okay. Can I just say one sentence? I'm talking too much, but just one sentence to clarify. I'm not saying that the internet doesn't play a role. Of course it does polarize. But if you look, as me and my team have done 3 or 4 years ago, we published a paper on this. a lot of these angry voices on Twitter, a lot of these angry voices on Facebook. What's the difference? And we studied what was the difference between those that very vocally spoke out in favor of ISIS and those that vocally spoke out in favor of ISIS and actually went to Syria. What makes the difference between someone talking a big game and someone actually packing their bags and going? And in many cases, the difference was the existence of a real life, real face-to-face contact. Because as many of you who study sociology will know, basic high-risk activism requires a lot of social ties. In order to convince someone to abandon their entire life and start a new life in a place like Syria, you need a lot of convincing, and face-to-face contacts facilitate that in addition to everything that happens.
Friendship and often also kinship, actually being related.
I think what we'll do is we'll try to take a couple of questions at a time. Does that seem reasonable? And then we'll see how we get on. So I haven't got my glasses, so I can't actually see anybody. You and maybe the person in your row as well, and then I will come to others. And sorry, forgive me, I must look up as well. Yeah. Okay, do we have microphones?
Hi, good evening. Thank you for your comments. Can everyone hear me? For your comments, I find it very interesting and learn a lot myself. If you permit a comment and a question, if that's possible, I'll be quick. I'm actually an imam of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. I'm working in the press office of the community, and I've been commissioned by the caliph. I also believe in a caliphate, and I've been commissioned by the caliph to work in the press office to speak to journalists and see how I can change the negative stereotype or the negative image of Islam in the media itself, and because of extremism and terrorism. My first comment is this, is that it's very interesting what Peter said about those people who join these terrorist groups. They have little knowledge about Islam. And also Elizabeth made a point that these Al-Qaeda groups, they don't give any women any rights. The reason why those two points resonated with me was because my wife is a British convert to Islam. She converted to Islam when she was 13, and she is a white British convert. And the reason why I say a white British convert is because that's how she refers to herself. And the reason why she converted was because she said Islam liberates women and she feels liberated. My question is this, is being a young British imam in this day and age, what do you think I can do to try and change the negative image or stereotype of Islam in the media? I had a meeting with Alan Rushbridge and he said, get yourself out there and see how you can change the narrative. In your opinion, what can I do to try and counter that narrative of Islam?
Okay, thank you. And maybe the person along the row as well, who, if we could just pass the microphone on. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So I thought your speech was very good today. It's, definitely extremism is a thing that I've been interested in for a long time. And my question is, in terms of extremists, why do they feel that they need to, you know, achieve their goals through violent means?
Thank you. Okay, so first of all, what could a young imam do to change the narrative and the context of some of these discussions? Anybody?
I can put my journalism professor hat on and be cynical. I think that it's incredibly hard in the media today because Islamophobia and anti-Muslim bigotry is incredibly politically effective. We've seen Boris Johnson kind of essentially use Muslim women as, you know, the strategy to become prime minister. Every day on the cover of the Times, there's another story that conflates, you know, Salafism, religion, Orthodox Islam equals violence. I think the really most productive thing, rather than being cynical, is to say that there needs to be more diversity in the media, because I think newsrooms in this country are very, very white. It's something like 94% white newsrooms. It's 6% people of color, different ethnic minority backgrounds. And when they are on staff, they tend to be on the terrorism beat. It's a kind of ghetto beat. They don't cover other things. And I think that apart from the kind of structures of ownership and the kind of news agendas of the big corporate media, which is a separate discussion, simply having more diversity in newsrooms is really important, because people who have a stake in covering not just their community, but covering other news and kind of integrating this idea of everyone is harmed when one group, a vulnerable group, is consistently demonized in the media, I think will affect some change.
Okay. Peter or Stefan, on why do extremists go straight to the violence button rather than something in between?
I don't think that most... Stefan perhaps knows a better answer to this, but I think that most radical or extremist groups try nonviolent things first and become violent typically. That's how they see it, as a response to the violence of others. So whether that's always correct or not is another question, but I can't think of any extremist group that I have personally studied that would have said, we're going to attack these people out of nothing because we don't like them. There's always a justification that construes your own violence as defensive violence. They've attacked us first, or they've raped our women. They've taken away something from us. And a lot of the videos that Elizabeth might have seen and that I have seen are about constructing that narrative of defense. Even when ISIS burned that Jordanian soldier, that Jordanian pilot in the cage, before that scene of that burning, it actually had 10 minutes where they were explaining how Jordanian fighter pilots and how American fighter pilots were bombing ISIS territory and therefore burning the population of the caliphate. And that therefore what they were doing to that fighter pilot was basically the same. So everyone constructs it. And just to emphasize that again, I'm not saying that's correct, but everyone constructs it as defensive violence. That's one point. And the second point is, let's not forget that over 80% of terrorist attacks globally, according to the START database, happens in the context of conflicts. Over 80% of terrorist attacks last year, for example, happened in just 5 countries: in Nigeria, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. With the possible exception of Pakistan, all countries in which you have civil conflicts. And even the remaining 20% are typically connected in some way to these conflicts. Even the attacks that happen in Europe, for example, are being justified as an asymmetric response to the conflict in Syria. So it's never just like, we're going to attack these people because we hate them. It's always as a response to something, whether that's correct or not.
Okay. Should we try a couple from upstairs, and then we'll come back down? At the front, and maybe two at the front here.
Hi. My question is about, I think you spent a lot of time discussing some of the social and maybe psychological or economic factors that lead to extremism. But I think what's missing from the conversation that ends up painting, in my opinion, a problematic picture of extremism is a discussion of the larger geopolitical factors. I mean, I think there was a mention of the Trump administration, but no mention of, for example, the war on terror, drone strikes, a little bit of talk about the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and how all of those things and essentially the Western imperialist agenda in the Middle East has been such a catalyst for global extremism. Because I think what happens when we leave that out of the conversation is extremism gets painted as a cancer in the religion of Islam, as opposed to the result of a very specific set of policies stemming from the West. So if you guys could just talk about that a bit.
Okay, and we just take another question here.
Hi, thank you. So my question is for all of you, kind of. You had mentioned some of the quite off-putting qualities that Al-Qaeda wants in their women, and it just kind of reminded me, there was an IDF tweet or ad about how women involved in the Great March of Return should just like stay in their houses or something like that. And it so kind of reminded me, of course, this is not about Islam, this is about filling in whatever narrative the party at hand wants, which maybe some people know, some people they don't. So I was just wondering, as journalists, as academics, do you feel a responsibility to sort of nullify or dispel the myths of Islam that you have come across? Like we've made kind of a lot of jokes about jihadism and taking multiple wives, etc. But being that we have drawn correlations, however minuscule they may be, between the marginalization of Muslims that are caused by these kind of stereotypes and laughy kind of things in Western countries, and the same radicalization you have had the privilege as mainly white journalists to research, are you non-actors? What is your place in that?
Okay, thank you. Do you want to maybe talk about, you mentioned some of the geopolitics. I take responsibility that, you know, we probably haven't discussed enough of that, but very quickly, is there something you want to add in terms of the perspective of, you know, is any conversation like this always ending up in a very narrow focus on, you know, terrible things that some people are doing without, I suppose my way of amplifying that would be to say every story really depends on where you start the story, and this particular questioner is saying you could start this story much earlier and you would have a completely different narrative. Is that fair?
I think that language always frames a discussion, and I think when we started, I tried to start by saying that I think the word extremism is unhelpful, and I think leads us down a path, and we have to fight our way out of it. I would be disappointed if your takeaway from the conversation was that we're focusing on, with excessive granularity, on these questions of context and why. I said from the outset, and I will say it again, I mean, I think that these big picture conflicts and interventions in the Middle East and wars are what has, in the Middle East, produced the circumstances that groups then who are insurgent groups, who have a variety of aims, secessionist, territorial, who come in and exploit the disorder for their own agendas. That fracture and those disorders are certainly a reflection of a war that has upended the Middle East, an American war and invasion, and also a regional set of dynamics that are shaped by primarily how America interacts with the Middle East and its relationship with Gulf allies. And the person who is supposed to be sitting in this chair, David Kirkpatrick, is in Istanbul researching what happened to, you know, the person we all know has disappeared. So none of these things are to the outside of the conversation. I mean, they are the map, and maybe we are zoning in with a lot of detail, trying to look at hows and whys and kind of use our geographic and linguistic knowledge to fill in the picture. But I think that's the structure of what we're talking about from my perspective.
Dispelling the myths?
Oh, dispelling the myths. Well, I guess if we're doing honest research on the region, in the region, and on how it works, and we're publishing and broadcasting our work, then we hope that that goes some way towards dispelling the myths. For example, I've been making the point that local communities in Yemen, at least, are tolerating, to some extent, extremist groups, not because of any notion of Islam or because they've been radicalized, but because their governments aren't doing enough. You know, it's got nothing to do with Islam. It's got to do with community development projects. And just on related to that, but on the other question, I think, as the lady up there said, geopolitics is all over this. Of course, it creates the circumstances for these groups to thrive. But we must be aware of the fact that everybody else lives in the region too and experiences the same geopolitics. So what we've been focusing on are those tipping factors. What is it over and above the common denominator that everybody experiences that pushes some people over the edge? And again, when I was mentioning the Al-Qaeda state in Yemen, and I was talking to a US audience, and they said, well, you know, they hate us, they want to kill us. And I had to point out that the 2016 Arab World Youth Survey actually showed that 82% of youth in Yemen consider America an enemy. So they don't necessarily want to kill them, but the geopolitics has angered such a vast number of the population that these kinds of feelings are not limited to extremist groups.
And I just wanted, I mean, to first of all, agree, of course, geopolitics is all over that, but it's not as simple as we often think. And the, for example, you mentioned imperialism. I think there's this very simplistic narrative. America is pursuing these imperial interests and moving the pieces on the chessboard. If you look at the history of the Obama administration, you see how they struggled at every step to make sense of this, with the Arab Spring, with every country, how they were kind of, should we, like, we would like to promote democracy, but then we can't, and what are our allies doing? And you saw the evolving situation with Syria, where they were resisting for a long time becoming involved because they didn't want to repeat the sort of mistakes that they thought that Bush had made. But by not doing anything, they got sucked in. So it's actually a lot more complicated than this simple idea of imperialism suggests. So yes, geopolitics is important, but unfortunately, in reality, I find it's often a lot more messy than the very easy narrative suggests.
Yeah,
and I, were you about to say? Yep.
And I think we've got to distinguish a lot individual groups, individual contexts, individual strategic objectives. You know, there are groups that are very much about local politics, you know, the near enemy. There are other groups that, that think that they should prioritize the global fight against against unbeliever imperialist regimes. And if you look at the origin of Islamist violence in the Middle East, most of that was local, was very much directed against local dictators. And of course, you can also put that into a geopolitical context, but then you get into, you know, a context of having caused that very far removed and very indirect.
So, for example, the question
would be, just one question.
If we're so unhappy with American imperialism under, say, Obama, are we happier now that Saudi is taking the lead? Are we happier that they are sort of intervening all over the place? Or wouldn't we prefer that America was kind of
reining them in? You're confusing me now. The audience questions are coming from there, not from here. A couple more. So at the back, maybe. Two at the back in the same row there, with the blue shirt and a slightly darker blue shirt, I think.
Thank you. I still have the feeling that, you know, if we're talking about global extremism, the focus still seems to feel a bit narrow, and to just, you know, I think there's something basic in humanity. You know, if you go back to the Spanish Inquisition, Nazi Germany, Pol Pot in Asia, Rwanda in Africa, there's a tendency in humanity to want to assert itself, and the way it asserts itself often is in this very extreme manner. You know, what was the economic position of the Spanish Inquisition? You know, it was about people, a group wanting to assert something that they, which was ultimately a sort of, on the pretext of values, really asserting power. So I invite your comments to sort of take a broader view of global extremism rather than just this focus on the sort of Islamist, you know, phenomenon.
Thank you. And if you could just pass the microphone along, a couple of seats. Thank you.
Hi there. I'm actually also an imam of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community, like my friend over here. My name is Mansour Clark. I'm usually too loud, but it turns out I'm not. my question is basically, I'm an imam, but I'm also a journalist as well. So I kind of like seeing it from two different angles, and often these are two groups that never usually have anything good to say about each other. But my question kind of thing is, in the beginning of the talk today, we talked about, much like my friend over here said, that we wouldn't only be focusing on Islamic or so-called Islamic terrorism or extremism. But of course, when we talk about a topic like this, then the topic and the conversation usually goes in towards that. But we were recently at a Frontline Club event with the very talented Dia Khan, who of course did a fantastic documentary, Emmy-winning documentary on white right and the rise of alt-right extremism. I wondered what the panel's views are on that, and also if they see any similarities between the extremists on one side of the spectrum and indeed the ones on the other. And also, fantastic, Dan, I'm in awe of your collective experience and your collective points. So thank you very much for today.
Thank you. I wonder whether we could just take both those questions as one, really. Whoever is brave enough to do that.
Stefan, you're brave enough.
Yes, Stefan, your turn.
Part of one. There's, I think, a fundamental debate in extremism studies or studies of political violence whether all extremist ideologies are essentially the same. So it's essentially about people seeking radical solutions, having a high tolerance for risk-taking behavior, and in the end it doesn't matter whether you become a member of IS or you become a neo-Nazi or you join a communist cell. And I think that's probably even the majority kind of sociological view. And I've in my own work with co-authors, we've pushed back against that. We've actually said that different ideologies are quite different, and they propose very different visions of society. And one argument that we've made in the book Engineers of Jihad is that actually radical, violent Salafist ideology has a lot in common with radical right-wing ideology in terms of wanting to restore lost order, wanting to restore lost hierarchies, defending the in-group against the out-group in a situation of being beleaguered and attacked by the rest of the world. And radical left-wing ideology is quite different with its revolutionary kind of forward-looking motivation. And it also turns out that radical right-wing and violent Islamist ideology attract people with quite similar profiles, both in terms of gender, in terms of levels of education, types of education, that are fundamentally different from the radical left. So I think we can actually learn quite a lot from comparing the radical right and the vision of society that it propounds with radical violent Islamist visions of trying to go back to a lost order at any cost.
And Peter, I suppose just to add to that, I mean, both those questions are also about historical perspective and whether...
Yes, for sure. I think the common denominator, if you want, and maybe there's a good paper or even book to be written about this, is totalitarianism. If I look at some of the publications of ISIS, they sound like Nazi publications. They talk about creating the new human. Creating a new person. That's Nazi language. If before ISIS, I would have said that's Nazi language. And it's about a certain totalitarian vision of humanity that gets imposed on everyone. But I wanted to actually answer the other question.
Okay.
Because I'm currently writing a book about Donald Trump's war on terror. And I found it very interesting. The reason we're not talking about it so much is because it is even more scary in a way, because it is the extremism of the majority. It actually is accommodated by people that are in power in some countries. And if you look at the alt-right, it's very, very clever. It no longer talks about race, it talks about culture. But everyone, David Duke, Ku Klux Klan, they understand it perfectly. It's a dog whistle. If people talk about culture, they know that what they really mean is race. They don't say racism, they say ethno-pluralism, which makes it sound very sophisticated, but means exactly the same thing. And so they talk about this, and they're happy to accommodate. They never distanced themselves. Last year in Charlottesville, they never distanced themselves from these people. They never speak out in support of these people. But these people understand perfectly well that these words and this language accommodates their agenda. And that, in a way, makes it even more dangerous than the five or six neo-Nazis who beat someone up, which is very unhappy for the person who gets beaten up, but isn't really a threat to the order, isn't really a threat to the system. So I think the alt-right is something that I think for the next 5, 6, 7, 10 years, a lot more people will have to study a lot more carefully.
Okay, a few more questions. Let's try here then, on this row. I will come to you, I promise.
Hi, everyone. I wanted to return to the point of women that go to ISIS to unite, that not just women, but teenagers from the West, Western countries, because you've said protection and dignity, they do not need that. Coming with their family and maybe being nurses or another profession that is useful and creating a society, that's not what a 16-year-old girl wants. And needing of adventure, yeah, but this is going to be simplistic, but I mean, you can just escape from home and go to a concert. So how they can brainwash, if we could say that, those people? Because, for example, in my country at least, after especially the Boko Haram kidnapping of girls, all the cases were treated as you go to that place to be married to somebody and have children. That was the only vision. So I cannot understand how a teenage girl from a Western country can just accept to go there.
Okay, and if we could just pass the microphone along. Thank you.
Yeah, so this is actually a perfect follow-on to Peter's kind of concluding comments there. So, and somewhat controversial, because I know there's LSE figures on the stage. This is kind of a debate amongst the students currently, I know in my dorm anyway, that there is actually a student who attended the protest in Charlottesville who is studying in LSE, and there's kind of this unofficial debate circulating around campus as to whether the student has the right to attend. And for me personally, I'm of the mindset that, you know, that whole prejudice and contact dialogue that they kind of teach us in social psychology, and the idea that group polarization is occurring, that's undeniable. How do we bring people who are either center-right or center-left kind of back to center to be more moderates? And I don't think the answer is exclusion, personally anyway. And I was wondering about what you guys think about having someone from that event attend a very liberal, you know, culturally diverse institute like LSE. What do you think of that? What would be your response?
Okay, thank you. So I wonder whether we just do the women question first, in the sense that, I hope I've got this right, there's a suggestion there that it still doesn't really make sense. Why would teenage girls from East London, say, want to install themselves in ISIS state or wherever? Do you have a...
I mean, I can tell you what they say. I can tell you what they read and who they interacted with and how the people who tried to recruit them, what they said to them and what these women said. I mean, these are things that are in the public realm and that we can look at. To just do it very quickly, and I agree it's hard. You know, a 16-year-old on the cusp of adulthood has some genuine intellectual awareness, some adult sense of the world, but is obviously still a minor and doesn't have adult judgment. You know, something that came back a lot in the early days when women who had gone to Syria were still able to be online and they were had not been kicked off all the social media platforms yet and they were still interacting, they were really offended at this idea that they were jihadi brides and that they had only gone for men. And they would push back against this and they would even, you know, tell journalists, you know, who on earth would leave the comfort of their home and family in East London and come to Syria in the middle of a war zone to get married? You know, do you think we are crazy? They said that. So their own self-expression and articulations of it were manifold. I mean, many of them had very explicit political grievances, the war on terror. They cited incidences of hate crimes against Muslims, this idea that the West was at war with Muslims, drone strikes would come up repeatedly. A narrative of, I guess you could call it grievance, that was very aware of the geopolitical circumstances that Muslims in the West were facing and in the Middle East. There was talk of marriage, though. I mean, there were pink memes being floated around and really saccharine kind of roses, and that was there. But I mean, maybe that's there in the back of every mind of every 16-year-old, no matter what they're planning to do. You know, was it some sort of, to me, something that has always been interesting is an idea of some kind of search for cosmopolitanism, because I think there are a lot of young women who, on the age of social media, want to be cosmopolitan. They want to have friends who speak multiple languages. They want to live and be globalized. And their identities are very much transnational as young Muslims. They don't necessarily see themselves as British Bangladeshi or British Pakistani. They see themselves as global Muslim transnational citizen of a Muslim world. And the recruitment and the language and the tweets and the Instagram stuff really, really cultivated that idea. You can come here, there are women from 50 places, you can study, you can work, you can be global in your own way, and you can cover. There was a lot of talk about you know, you can cover and you'll be safe, you will not be stigmatized, you'll not be marginalized. You know, the women themselves will say, finally, you know, I'm going somewhere where I can dress comfortably. You know, it seems counterintuitive, but they wouldn't go to a disco because they come, a lot of these women came from quite conservative Muslim families who didn't want to go to discos. They weren't into discos. They felt discos were being inflicted on them. They would like to be, you know, they wanted to be cosmopolitan, intellectual, educated young women without the burden of the disco. So just portraying this to you as they expressed it, and also, you know, hoping to convey that on the other side there was a very, very savvy awareness that they felt all those things, and the messages conveyed that. I think there was a particular like fake L'Oreal ad that said, you know, you can come here and have it all. Like, we know we can't have it all in the West. We finally learned that, but you know, the message was still being purveyed, if you will.
Okay. I don't think we can really talk about the individual case. I don't think that's particularly fair, but I think there is a broader point there that filters into this entire discussion about who is, you know, what are the terms of engagement, who is, you know, who is acceptable to talk to, who isn't, how do you decide that somebody's views are beyond the pale or whatever. I just wondered whether that might be the way to address it. Stefan?
Yeah. I can't comment on the specific case because I don't have the full information. I don't know what happened in the admissions office, you know, what was in the cover letter and things like that. But I would just go back to a point that I think Peter and others made on the panel, which is that radicalization on the micro level is usually a product of tightly knit and closed off social networks. So, you know, if we want to make sure that someone with potentially radical views stays radical, becomes more radical, then, you know, we exclude him, we push him back into the community with the tight social in-group links that have reared that kind of extremist sentiment in the first place. So I'm not a great fan of preaching to the choir, as it were. And I think you know, a chance of engagement with views that we find personally very objectionable is a very good thing.
Okay, we're sort of out of time, but I did promise that we would have a couple of questions from up there. I know lots of people have got their hands up. So we'll take one last round. We'll take four questions. The answers will have to be really brief. Two from up there and two from down here. So chat with the beard. And is there one other?
The beard.
Sorry, I know I'm not supposed to mention the ones. Forgive me. And this very nice person here in the group. So first up there.
There's so few nice people.
Thank you. I've forgotten my question now.
Yes. So,
it's a question regarding, you mentioned earlier how important terrorist recruiters were for the radicalization of individuals. Mm. And I think their social networks were key in order to achieve that. And having the question earlier regarding Dia Khan's documentary regarding the white right, and also another documentary I've heard about Darryl Davis's Accidental Hero, I think it's called, where by engaging people who are extremists of the far right, they were able to change hearts and minds. Now, I don't know how, to what extent the Prevent program, for example, is trying to achieve something similar, but is that something that's being missed in the whole idea of de-radicalization? Mm.
Thank you. And very quickly down here.
Hello. So my question is for Peter Newman, like regarding your research. So what did you notice about the differences between a local recruit, ISIS recruit, and an international or global recruit? Because, from my experience, I've, lived in Mosul post-war and the areas around Mosul. And, mostly people would rarely have had so much experience with, the international recruits. So were they treated differently? Did you notice any differences between these two? And the second question is for Elizabeth. You talked about Arabic poetry and your expertise in this field. You know poetry and its importance in the Arab world and the Islamic history. So the violence we see in ISIS, done by ISIS, do you trace it or correlate it with any, if you look at the Arab poetry, do you have fine traces in that?
Thank you. We'll just do these two, and then we'll take one last couple from here. So very, very briefly, Peter, do you want to take that one first, and maybe also address the de-radicalization strategy as well at the same time? So I think they're sort of connected.
So very briefly, as you encourage me.
That's great, thank you.
Very briefly, yes, there's a huge difference between local and international recruits. You can see that in the propaganda, but you also can see that in when people speak about each other. I think the predominant narrative for local Iraqis and Syrians to be recruited into a group like ISIS was about the sectarian conflict, was about feeling disempowered within the Iraqi system as Sunnis, etc., etc. That played almost no role for someone from England or France or Germany. So the appeals were completely different ones. And from the limited interviews that we did in 2014, we can see that quite often international recruits did not really like Syrian recruits very much, and vice versa, that Syrians were quite disparaging quite often about the internationals, who in many cases didn't speak Arabic, didn't have any intention of fitting in with local culture. Local culture was, of course, exactly what the internationals despised as un-Islamic, etc., etc. There's one, if you have time, there's one fantastic blog that was written by a French foreign fighter, which was incredibly racist. He was basically complaining about these bloody, dirty Arabs that he had to live amongst, who were so dirty, who couldn't keep order, who were loud, who were speaking all the time. If you read it, it could have been written by a member of the National Front, but it was written by a young Muslim French person who'd gone to Syria in the search for the global caliphate. He ended up not liking it very much. So that's the one that was long, but very briefly on the second question. De-radicalization, which is, of course, a topic in its own right. Again, I compare it to smoking. If you want to quit smoking, usually people tell you that you have to want it yourself. There has to be something inside you that wants to quit smoking. If other people try to convince you to stop smoking, but you quite like it, then it's not likely to succeed. So people, not everyone can be de-radicalized. If someone is very happy and content being part of an extremist group, it's almost impossible to get them out. But if he has or she has questions, doubts, that you can leverage, then you may have an in. Even in that case, it's not certain that you will be able to de-radicalize that person. But most de-radicalization programs are aimed at people who haven't settled in yet, who are at the beginning of the pathway, who haven't fully formed their extremist identity, and those who are at the very end of the pathway, who are starting to have doubts, who are disillusioned, who are looking for a way out, basically. And then de-radicalization programs can facilitate that. In other words, very briefly, it's not the silver bullet. Not everyone can de-radicalize. But it is a way of amplifying and facilitating the exit or preventing the intro into an extremist organization.
And Elizabeth, question addressed to you very briefly, if you can manage that.
Yes, there is violence in the poetry, as well as everything else. There's also lament for lost colleagues, nostalgia for bygone golden eras of Islam. There's everything in the poetry, as there is in prose. But just with regard to Islamic State, two poems stick in my mind. One is a poem which translates as Call to the Knife, which was basically a poem that was encouraging people to slit throats. And another one, which was an imperative, which was Massacre. And that came out just about 3 weeks before the Charlie Hebdo massacres, I think. There are very blatant poems. Al-Qaeda does it much better than Islamic State these days. It's far more sophisticated in its poetry. And we have a whole male bonding thing going on there, because the poetry is often sung as well as recited. Everyone joins in on the last word and punches their arm in the air. And you can see how a group situation might get into a group think that turns violent. I did see, watch a group poetry recital by some young guys from Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda-affiliated who were just sitting around. And the poem started, it was being extemporized, it started while they were singing about their truck, their set of wheels that they were all really proud of, and it had lots of Allahu Akbar flags on it, and it was souped up. And then each person sort of added a verse. And finally, someone comes in with a verse, قول أمريكا تجي المعركة, you know, tell America to come and join the battle. And they all join in and get really excited about it. And it goes back to the refrain, يا أسود الدين حبوا للجهاد, come, O lions of religion, come and join the jihad. And you can suddenly see this, what started as something quite innocent has been stirred up through this medium into something that's now pretty aggressive and wants to go and kill Americans. That's how it works.
Extraordinary. Okay, very briefly, we're way over time. In broadcasting, 10 minutes over, I'd never work again. that's just two quick questions. I know there's lots of people. But
yes and no.
Shall we say, in the light blue shirt at the back and the waistcoat, and I'm sorry if I've missed other people.
Okay, hi. In answer to the first imam's question, how to change the narrative, my advice is stop demonizing the West. Okay? All it does is create a sense of victimhood, which doesn't get you anywhere at all. It makes you feel very, very depressed and more prone to extremism than the opposite. There is no place on earth where a Muslim is freer as a human and to practice his religion than in the West. So that's my answer to our friend here. Now, my question was going to be, how effective do you think the Quilliam Foundation has been in combating radicalisation and extremism?
Okay, and the last question, with the waistcoat. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. This one's primarily addressed to Azadeh Moaveni, but generally also to all of you. You mentioned greater diversity in newsrooms as a factor for increasing the better reporting on global extremism. However, as a larger and larger amount of journalists go freelance, and as the crisis within journalism as an industry, especially among younger and early career journalists like myself, leads us to pursue freelance journalism, what would be a tip you would share with us all today in terms of best or ethical practice when covering global extremism for people starting up? Thank you.
Thank you. So very briefly, the question is about Quilliam, but I guess could be applied generally in terms of people working in this field. Anybody got a particular view? No. Anything you want to share? No? Yes? Okay.
I do have an answer, and the answer is that of course, it didn't kind of change much, but perhaps it was unfair to expect that of that organization or any organization. I do think that governments have a limited capability, and Quilliam initially was government-funded, have limited capability in free societies to engage in social engineering. And I think there was perhaps a flawed idea that you could engineer a grassroots movement with government money, which didn't quite work.
Okay. I think we're going to be thrown out in a moment, so literally one word. Career advice, quickly.
Freelance journalism is so difficult. You'll never be able to buy a house, even though you couldn't anyway.
okay, good. Okay.